Thanks, Solitude and organizers, for having me again at Solitude. We just left a month ago, so it doesn't feel like really we left. Although in between, there has been a temple, a new space that grew out quite fast with a fascinating story. I don't know if this is a return of the sacral or religious to the academy, or is a kind of secularization of religion, but maybe that's also a topic that we can address further on. Just before I start, I have to also say the paper that I present was co-written by my partner, Niloufar Tajeri, with whom I also worked here at the Academy on the project, which part I will present or that I worked or let's say adapted to the topic of the conference. It was called Thinking the Monument to Suburban Riots. So we decided to only extract one kind of memorial strategy, part of tradition if you want to have closer critical reading, namely reappropriation of two historical figures, which you see like Charles Fourier, Franz Fanon. The aim of this talk is to relate their political biographies or kind of reappropriate certain aspects of political theoretical legacy in order to rethink or kind of tell something about the segregated urban spaces, here banlieues, but we also worked with ghettos and interstitial spaces in London, especially in the last 50 years in Western metropolis, I'd say that saw much more intensified expression in urban riots or suburban riots that we talked about. So like kind of London, Paris, Lyon, LA, these were the most important places. In this talk, I will reach out also to the non-Western, to Casablanca, and show a certain interesting path of between colonial and the modern. Also relating to impossibility that Professor Abbas emphasized quite correctly yesterday, the impossibility in our project is to link two very different histories. On one side, the history of riots or the present of riots, which is usually something very destructive, a dissent in the society, and on the other side, the basically 20th century rereading of certain kind of monuments. Monument that usually stands as a generative force of consensus. So how to kind of rethink these two entities that at first glance exclude each other, right? So for us it was, of course, riots. We see it as some kind of symptomatic points which reach traumatic cores of the society itself. So basically you would have a very demonizing reactions towards the riots, or the moral majority says, well, they're burning their own cars or even kindergartens. You know, this is something very anti-political. So we try to go a little bit further on to see at least responses towards it are political. And our major task was kind of to develop some kind of dissensual form through monument to address the dissent. So it is within this frame that I wish to now reappropriate two progressive or liberation figures, Fanon and Fourier. Fanon's decolonization extends into banlieues, part one. Probably there is no need to really present in detail biography of Fanon. There is much written about it. There was also 50 years of his death a few years ago, so there has been many conferences and books, articles written on him. Let me just reiterate the core signifiers. Fanon was a radical psychiatrician. He was a Marxist. He was anti-colonial activist. And despite his too early death, he left a very important theoretical legacy. And this afterlife, theoretical also afterlife, was usually met either with an ardent support or a violent criticism. But today, even among the current, let's say, supporters of parts of Fanon thought, I think that there have been certain parts that have been silenced or disavowed. Think of otherwise sympathetic Homi Bhabha's introduction to Fanon for our times, so a new introduction after Sartre. This reading, in a sense, minimizes out or takes out even the violence and Marx from Fanon. Fanon is then easily musealized or inserted into an academic canon where it doesn't harm anyone. Instead of anti-colonial, we have a culturalist post-colonial Fanon. In this respect, we share more with the take of Achilles Mbembe and Olson's recent film concerning violence, also due to the topic of urban riots, theory and politics of violence meets decolonization. So what would those oppressed in banlieues, those wretched, not of the earth, but wretched of banlieue, what would they be reading when they would kind of focus on the wretched of the earth? So I'm trying to kind of reenact some kind of meeting between banlieue and Fanon. Before we do that, just a small disclaimer. Of course, it's true that conditions in Western urban periphery, even if it's periphery and the conditions are bad, of those sub-proletarianized, is not identical with conditions of colonialism or colonized people. However, there are strong traces of racism, colonialism, that kind of still insist or are inscribed into the segregated urban spaces and to the politics of exclusion of this population. This population has been at best treated as second-rate citizens and have been long subjugated to the daily violence and strong state surveillance, a kind of limit case that then becomes a kind of paradigm later on. Okay, let's start with a revindication, a bit of Fanon's theory of violence and how he sees that violence is inscribed in the colonial space. He departs from a very clear-cut divide. So you have the colonial world is a world cut in two. The dividing lines, the frontiers are shown by barracks and police stations. The zone where the natives live is not complementary to the zone inhabited by the settlers. The two zones are opposed. So Fanon at first sets presence or absence of repressive apparatuses as the major markers of this division, while in the second step he points out to the more general logic of compartmentalization. So this compartmentalization is accompanied by the memorial symbolic level, which remind us also of the gratitude towards civilization being civilized by the West. So here we have a quote, "A world compartmentalized, Manichaean and petrified, a world of statues. The statue of the general who led the conquest, the statue of the engineer who built the bridge. A world cocksure of itself, crushing with its stoniness the backbones of those scared by the whip. That is the colonial world. The colonial subject is a man penned in. Apartheid is but one method of compartmentalizing the colonial world. The first thing the colonial subject learns is to remain in his place and not overstep its limits. Hence, the dreams of the colonial subject are muscular dreams, dreams of action, dreams of aggressive vitality." So the post-colonial colonial space does not only facilitate a swift police intervention in order to quell revolts or riots or make visible, put a display of pure force to incite certain anger or even fear, rather, but also implies a regulation of public memory. Who and how are we remembered the history, our own history? For Fanon, this compartmentalization is not an eternal fact, but comes with a high risk for the colonial masters themselves. Why? Because it incites the dream of destruction and aggressive vitality, if we heard. Instead of moralizing about, let's say, this unjust colonial violence, Fanon points out that the violence will be also necessary to the anti-colonial struggle. He first suggests the political use of violence, which is as sharp as urban divide. Sorry, another quote. I will have two more quotes and then I will stop. I will have also some photos. So this is like a very textual start. It more mirrors my own professional deformation than Niloufar's, but then Okay, so the divide. To break up the colonial world does not mean that after the frontiers have been abolished, lines of communication will be set up between the two zones. The destruction of the colonial world is no more and no less than the abolition of one zone, its burial in the depths of the earth, or its expulsion from the country. So he doesn't really talk about reconciliation. That is clear for Fanon. Although at the end of the book, he comes much closer to, let's say, human emancipation and the work that has to be done in that side. Fanon invests almost redemptive power to the violence of the colonized, which implies a perhaps too naive, optimistic claim that violence will almost necessarily work in a purifying way as a clean sheet, as if it cannot turn, let's say, against itself, even if it's politically articulate. In the post-colonial banlieue, one should remember that the role and proportions of minority-majority are reversed. Those in banlieue oppressed are not the large majority of the population, at least not yet, as was the case in the colonial condition. Moreover, the call for expulsion is, in the post-colonial condition, targeted not towards the governing power, but to the oppressed themselves, as we often hear from the right-wing politicians, even from some supposedly left-wing politicians in different instances when we are talking about also refugees and not just migrants. But no matter how asymmetrical, Fanon believed that a part of this destructive core of violence, there is something that one needs to affirm or that is interesting to affirm. So the last quote, almost, I think, affirmative power of violence. For the colonized people, this violence, because it constitutes their only work, invests their characters with positive creative qualities. The practice of violence binds them together as a whole, since each individual forms a violent link in the grain chain, a part of the great organism of violence which has surged upward in reaction to the settlers' violence in the beginning. The groups recognize each other, and the future nation is already indivisible. The armed struggle mobilizes the people. That is to say, it froze them in one way and in one direction. It's important to observe that Fanon subverts the Hegelian model of master-slave dialectic. True, he departs in Hegelian way. The colonized learns to work to and has to work for their masters. But what he adds is that they will also learn to use the violence, which will paradoxically help them to emancipate. Thus, the core of the struggle for recognition is not education, the model of Bildung, so famously inscribed into German tradition, but education for violence. That's like also quite something, a huge pill that was difficult to swallow for many otherwise sympathetic readers of Fanon. However, this sharp Aufhebung is towards the end of the book of Fanon, gradually at least articulated in demand for universalized struggle for human emancipation. For the decolonization to really take place in the non-West but also in the West, it will have to take place on both sides and within both separated spatial zones. Conflict traverses the whole world, and it's not something of that has binary structures. So to connect this somehow, let's say, political lessons of how to read Fanon today for banlieue, I want to also bridge to, let's say, make a leap to Niloufar's research on Fourier and trajectories of architectural modernism. It's quite fascinating to show or to follow the migration of certain concepts and urban forms through time and spaces. Show a bit more complicated story and doesn't equate colonialism with modernism and so on. But why start with Fourier? He was one of the first people who, let's say, is famous for urban utopia, or kind of, let's say, Phalanstère is a mix of urban-rural utopia. And despite being more egalitarian community with quite sexually liberated relationships, where also children were supposed to be sent into a very different places because they are too noisy, he hasn't realized in his time. There were other people who were doing it. For example, Godin, Famille Ster is one example, which is in the north of France, or quite just across the border of Belgium. And these models were influencing later on modernism, especially Le Corbusier with La Ville Radieuse. It has to be said, it is urban-rural exclave at that time, isolated from the world or isolated from the city, put on the outside, either on outskirts or even completely outside. Tom Avermaet, in his contribution to colonial modernism, which was shown in Haus der Kultur in the Welt a few years ago, showed quite well how banlieue and collective housing kind of didn't simply emerge in the West, but were taken up from the urban experimenting in French colonies or protectorates also in North Africa, especially Morocco. A protectorate in the early 1950s was a space where bidonvilles were informal settlements, which were basically with quite bad also hygienic and other conditions. There was basically idea to kind of regulate the flow of the migrants, of rural migrants into the Casablanca and other cities. Despite being an enlightened idea to build housing and taking care of sanitary conditions in the emerging cities were the backbone of the governing policies, this idea of modern housing was permitted with a segregationist logic. In Casablanca, for example, they were constructed separately for Jews, for Moroccans and Europeans in a different part of the city. The colonial urban planning that controlled rural migration in Morocco was later on used, this is interesting how it traveled back into France, tackling Moroccan immigration later, Fonds d'Action Sociale, they were called, which organized separate educational housing programs. Back to Casablanca, that's one important thing. These were first collective housing. They were done by partners of Le Corbusier, 1952, and kind of they were doing research on bidonvilles or kind of vernacular architectures in Morocco in order to kind of build on or develop certain collective housing that would reflect certain organic, let's say, link or transition to the urban development. And then it came back to Europe. Interestingly, 1952, so kind of at the same time when these urban projects were happening, following the murder of Tunisian Union trade unionist leader, trade unions, Communist Party, and another nationalist party organized protests. And this protest on the 8th and 9th December snowballed into huge riots, and which left few hundreds dead. They are also considered as the major moment in independence path of Morocco a few years later, but this was like the time where this political organization, anti-colonial, really took a firmer grip. This was 52. 53, SIAM, the modernist conglomerate, let's say, focus was on bidonville. And it made a huge controversy between the participants, which later on leads to breakup. Grid as built environment was seen as a confrontation between colonizer colonized. This brings us to a more nuanced journey of the concept between modern, colonial, post-colonial, and undermine these, let's say, interchangeable terms or equation between coloniality and modernity. Lessons of the urban journey should be accompanied by the last, more political lesson from Fanon, who, despite being an ardent supporter of certain kind of modernization discourse, he was opposed to simple imitation of Europe. He's actually very much against it in the last pages of Wretch of the Earth. So he's also against the political importation of certain imaginaries, even if they come from the communist provenance. So concretely, he was against importing revolutionary subject as being the working class who will make a revolution and so on. He focused rather on peasant classes, and even more interestingly, on Lumpenproletariat. He was no idiot, so he didn't romanticize it, but he found it extremely inspiring, or let's say a new way to think also political event and organization. So the last very long quote, and then I finish with these quotes for sure. So who is Lumpenproletariat? The man whom the growing population of the country districts and colonial expropriation have brought to the desert to desert their family holding circle tirelessly around the different towns, hoping that one day or another they will be allowed inside. It is within this mass of humanity, these people of the shanty towns, at the core of the lumpen proletariat, that the rebellion will find its urban spearhead. For the lumpen proletariat, that horde of starving men, uprooted from their tribe and from their clan, constitutes one of the most spontaneous and most radically revolutionary forces of a colonized people. Lumpenproletariat, once it is constituted, brings all its forces to endanger the security of the town. It is the sign of the irrevocable decay, the gangrene ever present at the heart of colonial domination. They won't become reformed characters to please colonial society, fitting in with the morality of its rulers. Quite on the contrary, they take for granted the impossibility of their entering the city, save by hand, grenades and revolvers. These worthless less than men are rehabilitated in their own eyes and in the eyes of history, will once more go forward and march proudly in the great procession of the awakened nation. Prophetic, kind of. Structural analogy with those oppressed in banlieues, from young to structurally unemployed, hold some water. Lumpen proletariat is a structural category that Marx used to define dangerous classes, can be used as a reserve army of industrial or post-industrial working class today, or simply those redundant long-term, even for life. State has always responded with violence towards those that rioted. This was accompanied with the strategies of softer technique and also repressive techniques of mass incarceration, weaponized architecture, and heavily surveyed form of social life. So I said, not to be very romantic, also Fanon had different citations where he finds a possibility for counter-revolutionary tendency of Lumpenproletariat. So it's not necessarily that it will be a spearhead of certain only, let's say, good side of the history of revolution. But to add another layer to this, economical more, if being economically exploited today means being in a precarious position, we heard about the cashiers also as one part, but being non-exploited, that is unemployed, presents even worse condition. With stripping of state of social services, disinvesting further from those forsaken places, we have a population that is both non-exploited and excluded. There is only a strong relation to the police apparatus. Those excluded can become paradigmatic case spaces for, like what Abba said, a certain kind of exaggerated future. So we are not living in kind of Agambenian human condition already for 2,000 years, homo sacer that is excluded, but also included in political system. But it's a site and a process of long struggle and contradictory developments. Towards conclusion, this said, one should not understand also this take as a kind of Fanonian pamphlet to embrace simply riotous violence of lumpen proletariat or those that are struggling in urban riots. So kind of try to move beyond kind of romanticization on one side, but also victimization of this kind of just liberal, oh, we understand it's bad conditions. So, like, kind of trying to bridge, let's say, a little bit forward and undermine this kind of cliches of barbaric violence of those excluded. What we now have in the governmental policies, we have offering of certain recipes. The violence of rioters, of course, should be quelled by police or state emergency army violence. Those involved are then either imprisoned, and this is happening on a much more massive scale in the last cycle of violence, and, of course, they have to be re-educated in the proper Western European values, as we can hear even from intellectuals like Slavoj Žižek. While urbanistically, spatially, police has been joining the cohorts of urban planners. For example, they start to decide which spaces in the city are public, which road should be closed, where should cameras be put. This is now the work not of urban sociologists or people, but like of police. So this is one important part. Then, of course, also cultural workers, architects, other professionals are invited to participate, to better design prisons, to de-escalate the violence, while spectacles or cosmetic consultancy firms that kind of de-escalate violence in the public space. This is in the Netherlands very much developed, but it's also not foreign elsewhere. Okay, instead of entertaining on this terrain, Fanon and Fourier both in their own ways would suggest to break with this logic. Surely, Fanon's break was more sharp, universal, but what we found in Fourier is a profound anchoring in the urban practice, which would need to be now remodeled, not like put it in the exclave, but how to bring banlieue back to the core. Not only how we see today, how to rename the Place de la République, right? What you have here at the end, in the Place de la Commune. There are big revolts today in Paris against the big reform, but how to make visible all those squares that have been invisible or are visible only for sporadic violence of the riots. So for the very event, last minute, I have one more minute, no? Probably. Let's say, just like a self-authorized myself. One of the memorial strategies that we found of particular kind of valence or that has a potentiality today, the person that you see, of course, here is Charles Fourier. His monument stood in 1899. It was there till 1942, till Vichy, France, and on the order of Nazis, it was removed. And then, of course, only this plinth remained there. And this plinth is interesting, like as a kind of fundamental element of the monuments, right? A piedestal from which a sovereign speaks to you, or kind of, you know, there is a certain kind of legitimacy of the community. The interesting part, what happened was in 69, they've reenacted, or they put another Fourier there, but this Fourier was not to be celebrated for his own ideas. It was actually, what they would say, a tribute to Charles Fourier from the barricaders of the Rue Gay-Lussac. So to the barricades of 68, it was on the same day that the general strike in France happened. So there was a kind of political attempt to bring this missed encounter between the students and workers together in the play. So, of course, this memorial detournement was possible just because of this empty plinth. There is a nice interplay between the empty plinth and what comes there and how to leave it open. Of course, hours later, it was already put away. And then there was a lot of interventions till a few years ago, municipality puts a call for a new monument to the Charles Fourier, which, of course, even blocks the plinth away of any possible disturbance and put the apple there. So it's an apple. Apple becomes the chewing of Charles Fourier, or some kind, maybe the worm of Fourier is still inside, but rather you see a kind of what post-postmodern colorful apple can do to the open emptiness of Plinth. Thank you.